This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Into another episode of Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects. This is the cult and exploitation film cast with none of the fat, but all of the, well, fat, let's be honest. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined by my friend, my co-host, Lawrence of Acerbia himself, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
And we are continuing across the reconnaissance, the McGenre hay today. And today's movie is actually so cool, we didn't even need an intro for this episode. Just diving right into it.
This movie is it's one of those, again, I'm surprised that it's been relegated to this corner of history, that it is not better remembered.
Yeah.
And this movie is cool as hell.
It absolutely is, and we will tell you what it is in just a moment, but first, let's keep some house. We're available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can find our whole back catalog there. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And then, of course, every movie we talk about, we will put an Amazon link here on the page. If you click on that link, even if you don't buy that particular item, getting to Amazon and buying anything through that link benefits us. We really do appreciate it. And as I hinted to before, the gloves are coming off today as we continue McGenre, hey?
McGenre, hey!
All right.
It's a wazzy, it's a woozy, it's a...
Bring down the beast!
Matthew McGenre, hey!
Yeah!
Matthew McConaughey!
What? We're discussing our favorite genre films that feature the very talented, the very handsome, the very Texan Matthew McConaughey.
The very Austin.
The very Austin, even, Matthew McConaughey. And we are digging up a true gem today, a film that was praised by James Cameron, Sam Raimi, and Stephen King, the latter even calling the movie one of the best of the year that it was released, which was 2001. And that movie, of course, is Frailty.
Fuck yeah, it's Frailty.
There are demons among us. I can see the demons while other people can.
I'm scared, Dad.
Nothing that crazy could be real.
Frailty is a movie that flew under so many radars that it took this particular recording for me to finally see it. Because this has been a movie that has been on my must-watch list for such a long time.
I thought, you know, the excitement that you showed when when I first pitched McGenre Hey to you.
It was mostly because of Rain of Fire.
And yeah, well, but the thing is I said, you know, I was like, we should do Matthew McGenre Hey. And you're like, McGenre Hey, what are we going to talk about? Texas Chainsaw, The New Beginning? And it's like, no, we'll talk about Rain of Fire. And you're like, yes. And I go, you know, Frailty. And you're like, yes.
Well, I'd heard a lot of good things about it. I knew
No, but I thought you'd seen it, and knowing what I knew about this movie and having seen it several times, I just assumed it was part of your catalog.
It was not, but it is now. And no, I mean, it's like there was no chance I wasn't going to like this movie. Like
yeah,
it had just been talked up so much, and there was too many people in it that I liked, and the concept, I was aware of the core concept, obviously not the turn that the movie takes, but I was aware of the core concept, and it sounded phenomenal. This is a very different kind of thriller. This is kind of more in the... I mean, it's a religious thriller, so I guess on some level you could kind of put it more in the realm of
Fallen.
Something like Fallen.
No, you can very much put it in the realm of Fallen.
But yeah, like I said, this was a movie that wasn't just praised by critics. It was praised by other filmmakers. It was praised by legends, really.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is that it was directed by Bill Paxton,
oh, yeah,
who also stars in the movie, and if I'm not mistaken, I think this was his feature film directorial debut.
I believe so.
And then, unfortunately, for some reason, I think he displayed some really significant chops as a filmmaker, and yet he's only directed one other feature film.
And that movie's really good.
The Greatest Game Ever Played?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
No, it's a golf movie.
Yeah, no. That everybody looks at it and goes, oh, Bill Paxton directed a little golf movie with a young Shia LaBeouf. And it's like, who gives a shit about that? It's actually a really good movie.
And, you know, sports
Bill
movies.
Bill Paxton, between these two films, has shown the kind of level that we've seen out of, like, Tom Hanks or George Clooney. In that here are these guys who are great actors who are so good at doing what they do, who then when they're loosed to be directors, make really interesting things.
Well, and I will say this about sports movies is that when they're done well, they do have the ability, like people who don't like sports like great sports movies. But that being said, it was a golf movie, and I loathe everything about that game.
I think I'm going to have to tie you down and force you to watch The Greatest Game Ever Played, because it's, I'm not going to defend it as a great movie, because it is about, you know, a golf game in like the 19-something or the 1930-something, mm-hmm. But I've seen it twice, and I really like it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked last week about Reign of Fire, and how it was funny to see McConaughey as a Texan in England. Frailty takes place in a Texas town. And not only that, but it boasts not one, not two, but three Texas-born leads. Because Bill Paxton's from Texas.
Oh, yeah.
McConaughey obviously is from Texas. And Powers Booth is from Texas.
Yes, he is.
So, yeah, you have three Texas-born leads in a film that takes place in a Texas town. It is one of the most Texas movies ever made. It
really is.
And the basic plot structure here.
And writer Brett Hanley.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
Ended up, I don't know if he was from here, but I know he came and moved here, and he lived here for at least a decade.
Well, that happens to a lot of us. Sometimes you just come visit, and then you don't leave.
Yeah, Indianapolis.
Yeah, right? He was actually born in Dallas, Texas, for the record. So the basic plot structure here is that Matthew McConaughey plays Fenton Meeks, who shows up at an FBI regional office. And tells there now the FBI at this time has its hands full looking for the Hand of God serial killer, this guy who is murdering people and basically telling them that God was telling him to do it. And Matthew McConaughey walks in, drives an ambulance up to the front door, and says, "I know who the Hand of God killer is." And this doubting FBI agent played by Powers Booth is like, "All right, tell me what you know." And he proceeds to lay on the table this story about when he and his brother were young and, you know, they were living with their father, played by Bill Paxton, and it was just the three of them. And then one day their father wakes them up in the middle of the night telling them, "I've had a vision from God and I've been endowed with this mission where I am going to destroy demons living among us." And they're just like, what does that even mean? And then later on, he gets another vision that gives him a list of names. And he literally just starts scooping people up and murdering them with an axe.
In their shed.
In the shed. And like having the boys help bury the bodies. And it's like really, it's a bizarre situation. And he doesn't, there's these holy weapons even. You know, there was a vision to tell him where the axe was and where the lead pipe was that he'll hit people over the head with and then tie them up. And he, you know, he comes into the shed and he takes his gloves off and he touches them. And he says that he can see all of their sins. And then he tells the kids, "Oh, this guy was a child murderer. This guy, you know, this woman killed her husband," whatever. And so the younger brother kind of buys into it and totally believes dad. The older brother is like, "We need to get the fuck out of here because dad's a murderer." And it's about kind of the struggle for him to get anyone to believe the story. And then, of course, on top of that, with the time jump, we're watching Matthew McConaughey relay all this information to Powers Booth and then tell, I can take you exactly where all these bodies are buried. And so it has that sort of reflective, almost like nostalgic quality to it, except that it's a really horrific story from the, I mean, it's not like Stand By Me where it's like, "I remember this time we went to see a dead body." It's like, "I remember this time we created a bunch of fucking dead bodies." Yeah. And you know, that's the basic structure of the movie.
Yeah. And it is wonderfully crafted, and it is a film that slowly takes its time and really, it really does. It's set in 19, you know, the flashbacks are set in 1979.
Yeah.
And it very much feels like 1979. Like True. A lot of these movies, you know, feel like they're nostalgic for their time. And this movie does such a great job of setting you, you know, so squarely in the limitations of the time.
Yeah.
And without pointing them out, but, making a film that very much feels like this could have happened then for all of these reasons.
It avoids something that I've seen in movies that I've dubbed the jukebox blinders,
where a lot of movies will tell you what time that you're in by just blaring pop music from that era. And immediately, like, see, here you are. And it's not as authentic as they think it is. They're just blaring, you know, pop culture at you. And yes, exactly.
How many times have we heard that song in a movie to tell you this is when this movie was made?
Exactly. So, I mean, this movie relies more on just, like, smaller tactile things. Like, there's the beer that people drink. Like, you know, it's just, like, little details.
Oh, yeah, he's drinking hams with the tear-off, you know.
Yeah, with the pop tab.
With the pop tab. And you know, it's all rotary phones. And it's, you know, these small little houses and these old cars that just kind of rattle along.
And the two kids are arguing about which movie they're going to go see.
Yes.
Meatballs or The Warriors. Two films that I feel like could definitely be covered on this show. In fact, we kind of covered The Warriors with our Michael Beck episode.
We did cover The Warriors, and Meatballs is kind of hard because it's become dated in a way that you...
I love Meatballs.
I love Meatballs too, but it's sexual harassment the movie. I mean, let's be fair.
All the boner jams are sexual harassment in the movie.
No, not like Bill Murray is our hero of the movie, and he spends the entire movie sexually harassing his coworker into a sexual relationship.
How fucking dare
really,
you?
It's go back and rewatch it through that
I've
lens.
Watched it every other month. I love that movie.
Oh my God, he's so
how fucking
it's so
dare
uncomfortable
you?
To watch him sexually harass and pat the ass of his coworker who wants nothing to do with him until the end.
But the younger brother of this film does want something to do with that movie because that's the one he wants to go see
instead of the Warriors
so
because he chose wrong,
he's crazy,
which is why he's fucking nuts in this movie.
Signpost number the first, obviously this kid is crazy because he doesn't want to see the Warriors. Unbelievable. Anyway, so yeah, I mean that's really the interesting part of this movie is that McConaughey is a central character and isn't. You know what I mean? Like he
and this is the first of two movies where we're going to discuss that, where
he's kind of bookending the movie.
Yeah, he's a character who, while he is not in most of the scenes in the movie, he can be felt throughout the movie.
Yes, absolutely.
And this is one of the movies where he actually has more scenes, I believe, in this movie than he does in our next week's movie.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. But he is sort of a narrative bookend for the film. He's there at the beginning, and he's there, you know, he pops up a couple times in very short snippets throughout the movie. But what this movie's really about is this childhood, is this very unfortunate childhood that these kids had. And I think it's interesting because it's a different twist on the serial killer movie, because the serial killer in the movie is not some sadistic monster who's just doing this because it gives him some kind of thrill.
Yeah.
He legitimately believes that what he is doing is right. And it reminds me of all the best supervillain stories that you'll ever read in comic books.
Yeah.
Because the best supervillains are not the ones that are just mustache twirling, you know, broadly drawn bad guys. They're the ones who believe that what they're doing is right. They're the ones who believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that they have made the right decision and that the rest of the world doesn't understand. And so their moral compass is completely set at north, because they don't see what they're doing is wrong. And throughout this movie, Bill Paxton refuses to let the kids use the word kill or murder. He says, I've never murdered anyone in my life. I destroy demons. So the word destroy is like the only acceptable verb to him, because again, he believes what he is doing is right. And throughout the course of the film, we're left with that question, is this for real? Is there something supernatural going on? Or is Bill Paxton just, you know, wired a little bit differently from the rest of humanity?
Yeah.
And I think that's the really interesting thing about it. And I think that's what makes it stand apart from your basic serial killer movie.
Yeah, it is. It's a movie that's steeped in its childhood nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And watching a serial killer story from that perspective, which makes this story quite unique. You know, it's really is, you know, this kid kind of trying to fight against this and rebel and be like, Dad, no, you can't do this. And this dad being so sure of it. And there's so much truth in this story. You know, you even remove the killing and you take that element out of it, and you see very much the whole notion of a child trying to save its parent, even when it doesn't fully understand what it's doing. It's just this script gets it, and it gets it so hard. And then when it adds in the genre elements, it's just so brutal and rough and raw, mm-hmm. and its own thing. There is no other film quite like it, except, I would argue, maybe Fallen.
And it's, and I think it's interesting, the last three films that we've talked about, Fallen, Reign of Fire, and now this movie, the common thread that they all share is that they buck the idea of kind of the traditional perspective. For example, Fallen, obviously, as we mentioned, and I'm going to spoil that if you haven't seen it, I'm about to spoil it, is a film told from the demon's perspective.
Yeah.
Reign of Fire is a film in which the conventional action hero is not the actual action hero of the movie. He's the secondary character. And in this movie, of course...
Here it comes.
We are seeing...
Spoiler!
We are seeing a serial killer story. Well, I'm going to stick with the first couple acts. We're seeing a serial killer story from a kid's perspective growing up in the house. Basically... You know, growing up in the house where the serial killer is operating.
I'm going to spoil it because it's time. It's coming up. If you have not seen Frailty yet and you're intrigued, pause it right now. Go fucking watch Frailty and then come back and be like, oh, holy shit. They didn't tell me about that.
Yeah.
It's real.
It's real.
And that's the thing about this movie is watching it through multiple times. You know, it's like Fallen. It's a very different movie because, as it turns out, McConaughey's lying. He's another unreliable narrator. He's not the brother he claims he is.
Right.
He's the other brother. And that's the clunkiest part. If there's any clunky part to this movie, it's where, you know, Powers Booth is like, wait, I don't understand. He's like, you'd understand if you understand that I'm the other brother. And it's like, wait, that... Okay, like that makes sense, but you're acting like he shouldn't be confused. He should be confused because you've been lying, you son of a bitch.
When you give someone a fake name and then don't understand why they don't know who you really are.
Yeah, you don't get condescending about the fact that you've been lying the entire fucking movie. So that's the only, but I understand that it has to exist to bridge what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because what they end up doing is, oh, hey, by the way, the brother that we've been following the whole movie is actually not in as a character. He's not one of the main characters at all.
Right.
We're following him, but the Matthew McConaughey is the other brother who seems like the side character. And as it turns out, oh yeah, he was right. And the brother was a demon and the brother turned out to be evil just as the angels told him he would. And he had to put an end to his brother and then had to put an end to this evil son of a bitch FBI agent who has been hiding the fact that he is
also a murderer.
He is also a murderer. And as it turns out, not only was Paxton right, but Matthew McConaughey is a serial killer, but a serial killer working for God. And he's the good guy.
He's on a mission
for
God.
So you think he's a good guy, then you realize he might be the bad guy. And as it turns out, oh no, he's the good guy all along. And this FBI agent is one of the bad guys. Yeah. And this movie plays with a lot of tropes.
Yeah.
And when you break it down, you're like, okay, these are kind of conventional tropes.
But then it has more twists than a Chubby Checker album.
It
is the other thing.
It really does. Yeah. And on top of that, they're done. All of these twists are plays in of movies we've never seen before. So this movie at several various points are three different movies we've never seen. It's a movie about a kid trying to deal with the fact that his dad is a serial killer. It's a movie about a guy leading an FBI agent to the scene of the burials of his brother, who turns out to be this famous serial killer. And then it's a movie about a guy being guided by angels to destroy demons.
Yeah.
And it is, you have not seen, name one film that's like any of those. And it's all of them at various points in this movie. And it's so fucking good.
And I will say this, as someone who was literally watching this for the first time, that was the first question I started asking myself is, okay, is this really supernatural, or is it just that this is a story about a very unfortunate childhood for these two kids whose dad was insane?
Yeah.
Like, the literal definition, like, didn't know right from wrong, insane. And it was funny because when you don't know and you're watching the movie, I will give the movie credit because when you don't know what the twist is going to be, the first couple acts of this movie should be so stupid. they really shouldn't work, because you're literally watching Bill Paxton take somebody into a shed, take his glove off, touch their forehead and go, oh, we should kill them. Because it kind of reminds me of, like, the story of Joseph Smith. Dum, 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 dum. Where it's like, no, no, kids, I know you can't see it, but he totally is a child murderer, and God wants me to kill him. Dum, 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 dum. It feels like a very self-serving psychosis.
Well, and it feels like the type of movie you'd expect out of Hollywood at that point, which is, we're going to point at religion and make fun of religion.
Exactly.
And, oh, you know, this is, you know, you believe these things, but you only believe them because you're being told.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, hey, we're going to pull the rug out from under you. And, right. Oh, yeah. No, Bill Paxton wasn't lying at all.
Bill Paxton, he killed some demons. Dum, dum, dum,
dum, dum. And then when Bill Paxton gets it in the chest with an axe, the second, because you've only watched it for the first time, mm-hmm. the second time you watch it, that's it's tragic.
Yeah.
It is, here's this guy who loves his son so much that while he believes this angel hard enough to go out and drag random strangers off the street. And by the way, one of the interesting things about this movie is that the logic of the movie holds up throughout the entire film. You know, he's come up with this list and he never explains how he knows these people or how he comes by them. Mm-hmm. But by the time you see the end, all of those holes get filled up because you're like, holy shit, Bill Paxton is really getting a list from God of all these evil fucking people, which is why he has to drive to Dallas to drag some girl off his fucking porch mm-hmm. exactly when no one is looking into a van and drive back to his small town.
And that is clue number one that he's not actually, because the thing you think first mm-hmm. of all is that, again, the self-serving thing and the Joseph Smith comparison is that there's some reason that he's getting rid of these people. Some,
yeah.
You know, that this list isn't arbitrary. He had to know these names. So you think these must be people that he knows, he has some grudge against. They even hint at it when the kid, when the younger brother tries to say, like, hey, I got a list too. And his dad goes, wait, this is just the kid that was bullying you. He was throwing rocks at you. You can't just, you know, make names up and then you're like, okay, that's kind of red flag one. And red flag two is, if he is crazy, he still has to get these names from somewhere, so they would have to be people that he knows, and yet it's obvious from the interactions with the victims before he nabs them, none of them know him.
Yeah.
So, and he's, and like you said, he's going to these, like, great distances to find them, and he has their names. Like, serial killers, like, it's not like they know your name before they abduct you, you know what I mean? Like, that's what it is, it's randomized. But the fact that he has these names, if he is crazy, means that he has to know them. And the fact that it's obvious that he doesn't is the first red flag that something else is going on.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. But, you know, going back to that scene you're talking about where he gets the axe in the chest, we watch him throughout the whole movie. And again, this is actually interesting to speak to from, you know, watching it for the first time. We see him as this, like, even, you know, whether you're in doubt about his intentions or not, he does some things that have typically been associated with, you know, crazy, conservative, right-wing, oppressive religious households.
Yeah.
Like, when he feels that the older brother isn't seeing the visions, isn't seeing the demons, he locks him in the damn cellar for days.
The cellar that, now, first of all, he makes him dig the cellar.
He makes him dig the cellar where they're going to be committing murders.
And then he locks him in the cellar.
Yeah.
Until he has his vision.
For a week without food, he locks him in here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's so hard to rally behind the, and I think this is the testament to the storytelling, is it's so hard to get behind the idea, even if that doubt is lingering in the back of your mind that maybe something is going on, maybe this is for real, even if you have that, you know, doubt, like if you're actually behind Paxton in any subconscious level, it's still hard to get behind him because of all this, what appears to be oppressively Christian, oppressively religious upbringing shit that's going on. And I think that's what's, like you mentioned before, I think that's what's so smart about it, is it looks like a film that's lambasting religion when in fact it is not at all.
Yeah.
And I love that turn. But I also find it interesting, and the more I think about it, how much fucking Identity ripped this movie off in terms of its structure.
Oh, yes.
Because Identity starts with, you know, they're bringing in a prisoner. He's going to tell you a story about what's going on. Look, he's an unreliable narrator. And at the end, everybody who's listening to the story is in danger because of what's really going on and who this guy really is. And it's like, the whole time I watch this movie, I'm like, fucking Identity just blatantly ripped off the structure of this movie. It filled the middle bit with completely different content, I'll grant you, but the structure is exactly the same. Like, to the point that it ends out in a wooded area with the person listening to the story, you know, getting axed. Like, it's just, it's fucking crazy.
Yeah, no, this movie is one of those movies that caused a lot of waves in the underground, but never hit the mainstream the way it should have. And I've been surprised that, it's such a good movie, and it's a movie that is so... It's so rare that you see really good Christian horror.
True.
Because most of the time, as Christians often argue, Hollywood does not take well to Christianity, and that's not an exaggeration. So when you see really good, interesting Christian horror, where by the end, the Christians are the good guys, especially the fundamentalist Christians, it's surprising. And this movie handles that really well. And that ending is so dark and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a movie that keeps changing what you think you're watching. And by the time you get to that end, you're like, Jesus Christ, this movie is something else. And so watching it a second time, you're like, this is a movie about what happens when you believe something that everyone else thinks is nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right.
It's actually a way more faith-based movie than something like Left Behind. Like
absolutely.
It's a movie that delves into faith, yes, in a way more powerful manner than an actual Christian faith-based movie.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. This is one of the better Christian genre films ever made.
Yeah.
Easily. And I say better only because I have not spent enough time thinking about what the best Christian genre film is.
I think you've spent exactly as much time as you probably should pondering that question.
As both a Christian and a genre film lover, maybe I should spend a little more time. I would argue that Passion of the Christ, as we joked about last week, might be the best genre Christian film ever made.
Yeah, but I don't understand how that's supposed to give anybody faith.
You've not seen it.
No, but I'm sorry. I'm watching snuff film for 2 hours and going, oh yeah, no, I totally believe.
You have no idea. Well,
I've been a fucking Bible study. We'll don't tell me a, I have no idea. We'll, don't we'll, be patronizing.
No. Because you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying you don't understand. You don't understand faith, boy.
I don't understand how watching somebody get tortured.
You'd be the guy who take an axe to Bill Paxton. That's who you are.
Yeah.
You're that kid who becomes the hand of God killer who kills these women and molests them and buries them in his basement.
If you could make the argument that anyone was full of demons lately, Mel Gibson might be high up on that list. I'm just going to throw that out there. He's definitely been battling some demons, and I have the voicemail messages to prove it. I'm just going to say. So, yeah.
I think you're lying.
I'm not lying.
I think you don't have
voicemail messages. I think you're a demon. They're not my voicemail messages, but definitely pulled them off the internet when they were made available.
Mm-hmm. I love them mustard and biscuits.
You will smile and blow me. But Frailty, as far as Matthew McConaughey goes, what I really like about his performance...
Like 12 different segues in that section.
Yeah.
And I apologize to anybody who suffered through that going, what the fuck are they doing?
What we usually do, unfortunately. Matthew McConaughey in this movie, what I like about it is knowing where he ends up and knowing exactly, after you've seen it and you think about his performance, he looks so fucking broken. Like, he plays this role with this real quiet intensity, but he also is just so downtrodden, and they've made him up to look pretty sickly. He looks like a completely broken individual. And one of the first things he talks about is how, like, he's turning his brother in. He tells the story about how his brother committed suicide, which turns out, of course, because he's an unreliable narrator, to not be the case, but his brother is dead. So it's just interesting to me that even his character knowing, everything that he knows and having a clear mission and knowing exactly what he's going to do at the end of this conversation, he maintains this level of just complete brokenness that makes him sympathetic.
Yeah.
And it's such a great lure. It is such a great lure for the audience. I really think he does a tremendous job. And I know this sounds like a cop-out praise, but I really do think that how understated he is in this performance works wonders, because he's not giving away the farm. He's not showing his hand.
No.
And because of that, the turn is actually really effective.
Yeah. And there's so much buried in this movie. Like, it is
literally.
No, but yes, literally. But no, there's a term that Chuck Palahniuk coined called burying guns, which is where you take a story element and you put it out in the forefront and you just like drop it out there. And then the audience throws it away because they think it's, you know, it's nothing. It's not a big deal, but it plays in later.
Oh, the gun in the first act thing.
Oh, well, the whole in the when he first meets Powers Booth, mm-hmm. he won't stop talking to him about the picture of his mother.
Yeah.
And in the first time you watch it, you're like, oh, this is a guy who's trying to get to know the FBI agent, trying to create a bond, trying to find a way that they can bond. And this guy doesn't want to talk about his mom. And then when you get to the end of the movie and you see the scene where Powers Booth fucking butchers his mother with a knife.
Jesus.
And you're just like, holy shit, from the get-go. He's trying to get a read on this guy and playing with him because he knows exactly who this guy is and he's going to lure this motherfucker out.
And if you thought Norman Bates had mommy issues, just wait till you watch Powers Booth butcher his mother outside next to the laundry. Oh my God. Oh,
wow. That's
because it goes on for so long.
It doesn't. It seems like it does because Bill Paxton gets what he's doing.
Well, but here's the thing.
That does not go on nearly as long as it seems to. Just Bill Paxton captures those moments so well.
No, it is 200% more violent than any other scene in the entire movie. Most of the scenes, like even most of the axe murderings, there's no blood whatsoever. No.
In fact, you don't even see the axe murdering.
So it does go on. Not only does it go on longer than most murders in the movie, it also is far, far bloodier. So it is really shocking. It is the most shocking kill in the movie, and it's supposed to be, but it does go on for a while. It's like we see the flash, and it's like you think it's going to be the one, like he's going to bring the knife down once, like Bill Paxton did with the axe once, and then it goes back, and then it goes back again, and it's like, holy shit, like, I guess we're going to see him quarter her as well. What the hell? But it, like I said, it really works because the rest of the movie has been so withholding with its violence, and that was another impressive thing to me, is how well they built tension. When it's not a really violent movie, it's not an explicitly violent movie, and like I said, when you don't know the twist that's coming, most of the tension is Bill Paxton just putting his hands on people, freaking out, and then describing what he saw without us actually seeing it. So it's really interesting, and it's a nod to the quality of the storytelling that even those moments when you first watch it are tense when they shouldn't be.
And you know, one of the things I got to say, this child actor, and I don't know his name, but the child actor who plays the kid who McConaughey turns out to be.
Oh, yeah.
Has this great moment.
Jeremy Sumpter.
Yeah. Where he's just talking to his, he's like, yeah, no, I've seen it. And he says it in that way that a kid says, I believe in Santa.
Mm-hmm.
Like he says, he nails that line to where you're just like, yeah, this kid thinks he saw something because he wants to have seen something. He wants to believe his dad because he's too young and too innocent and too naive. And then you get to the end of the movie and you see what he saw and you're like, holy shit. I mean, that kid really nailed. And when you go back and watch it again, there's real belief there, mm-hmm. but there's real belief said in the way that you just don't believe him.
Right.
Like, he's like, you're never going to believe what happened to me on the way home from school. You're right, kid. I'm not. This is all a bullshit story. No, you did not see demons from hell. And, oh, hey, look, they're demons from hell.
Right. Funny story, going back to the whole idea of grounding this movie in Texas, that kid went on to play J.D. McCoy on Friday Night Lights. So
there you go.
There you go. And funny enough, one of the things I really, like I said before, this movie just keeps twisting. It just like, it sticks the knife in you, like, oh, that's surprising. And then it does it again. You're like, oh, that's even more surprising. It's like, ah, oh, that really hurts now. Stop it. At the end, when you find out that Matthew McConaughey not only is the younger brother, but is the fucking sheriff of this town.
Now, after his brother was responsible for the death of the sheriff in that town.
Right, exactly. So he comes in, he takes over. There's a great line where you realize that his wife now also believes in
God.
And she's pregnant, and it's like, oh, this is just going to keep going.
Yeah.
This is a handed down assignment from God, which is, you know, funny enough, the two kids that go riding by, the last shot of this movie, there's these two little kids on scooters that go riding by in front of McConaughey, and it's the two actors that play the boys when they're younger, which I think, again, just kind of hints at like the cyclical nature of what's going on here. But the axe itself, they call it Otis. And there's a couple of different theories about why the axe is called Otis. One of the theories is that Bill Paxton's name in the movie, because we only know him as Dad.
Yeah.
And even in the official cast, he's credited as Dad Meeks, M-I-K-S, because they're going to inherit the earth. But he's only listed as Dad Meeks. And there's one theory that his first name is Otis, which is another hint that it's like an heirloom. It's something that gets passed down. Once again, you know, calling to the familial nature, like this is a hereditary mission from God that is going to be handed down through the ages. The other theory is that it's an acronym for Only the Innocent Survive, which I don't really know which theory I subscribe to, because the axe, if I remember correctly, is not found in his own barn.
No. He finds it driving down the road and he sees the shaft of life coming down from the clouds, illuminating the barn. He walks into the barn and it's bright and it has Otis on it.
So if it's his axe and his name is Otis, why would his name be carved on an axe in somebody else's barn?
I think that's horseshit. I think that's one of those things where people are kind of reaching to try to find something.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't subscribe to the information that the movie gives us. It requires us to create our own.
Right.
You have to believe that he already had, for that to work, he already had the axe, and that what we saw was a hallucination, when all evidence to the contrary, everything he saw turns out to be real.
But there's obviously a significance to the name one way or the other, because it is almost like a Lady of the Lake moment. Like, it's very Arthurian that there's this beam of light guiding him to the axe and a stump, almost like Excalibur in the stone, and it already has the name Otis on it. So I really feel like it has to mean something.
I feel like it's one of those elements that kind of grounds this to what it is. You know, this is a Texas movie. This is a Texas horror movie, and this is a horror movie. I mean, let's get down to it. This movie is about as Texas as it gets. God is the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
The serial killer is killing demons because God told him to.
Right.
And I feel like that you nailed it. It's the Lady in the Lake moment, that by giving the axe a name, you make the axe more powerful. By the fact that every scene we see this axe in, we see that carving of Otis in it, gives that axe personality and makes it special and makes it something more than something he just pulled out of fucking Lowe's.
Right.
And, you know, just pulled off a shelf and is murdering people with. No, he found this thing waiting for him with a name carved into it. And he saw the gloves and he knew he had to take the gloves, even though he didn't know what the gloves meant. And then it turns out the gloves were a weapon as well. I mean, it's just classic myth making. By, you know, it's, there's a great scene in an episode of Community where Joel McHale holds up a pencil and says, you know, I'm going to tell you that this pencil's name is Clive. And then he snaps.
Everybody gasps
and he goes, and a little piece of you just died. Right. And by giving it the name Otis, that by embodying it with a personality and a name that's like just deep in the mud of what this movie fucking is, I feel like that creates that legend that needs to be created to sustain the rest of the movie, because you have to believe that this axe means something. And at the same time that you believe that that Bill Paxton's dad character is subscribing meaning to it. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you find out that there really is meaning to it, that it really is in some way this magical weapon that is helping guide them on their quest.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not the type of thing that this is not the type of movie that has too much buried in it, that this is the type of movie that understands structure so well and understands storytelling so well, and that Brett Hanley really did nail what he was trying to get, that he named it Otis because he knew by naming it Otis, it would create a certain level of disbelief in the audience that would then become proper belief when the story unfolded.
Well, and I really do think that Paxton and Hanley they did want the audience to start subscribing a certain level of their own meaning to it. Because if you think about the title of this movie, the title of this movie is never spoken by anyone in the film.
No.
And even Hanley is like, to me, what it always represented was the frailty of perception. But then he also added, also, I just like abstract titles. But if it's just an abstract title, if it doesn't have, you know, a significant meaning to it, then why, when Lionsgate tried to change this movie to God's Hands, did Bill Paxton fight so hard against it? I really do think there is a meaning to that, And I think the, like, when you listen to commentaries, I think how playfully evasive they are about it. I really do think they wanted, there are certain things in this movie that they did want people to assign their own meaning to and kind of give their own perspective to. I do like the idea that naming it Otis just makes it more powerful.
Yeah.
Because that does make sense. But I think it's one of those things that you can kind of make cases for one way or the other.
Oh, yeah.
Except, again, that it was his axe, because why would it be in somebody else's barn?
Yeah,
sorry,
no.
I don't buy.
I don't buy that.
That one I don't buy. And funny enough, we were talking about how in the movie, it's not until the very end, until the curtain has been pulled back, that you see the visions, that you see, you see what Bill Paxton saw, because obviously there would be no doubt. There would be no, I mean, maybe to a certain degree you could say, well, those are hallucinations in his head, but a large portion of the doubt that supernatural things are going on would be removed if you actually saw them. Not to mention the fact that we're dealing with an issue of faith. If we see that, and then the kid says that he saw it, we have no reason to doubt the kid because we have seen it as well. Funny enough, the original draft of the script had us seeing all those visions at the beginning, and it was James Cameron who told Bill Paxton, you know, it'd be a lot more powerful if you just save that for the end. Like, yeah. once you know, things have been revealed and then you see those visions, that would just be a lot more powerful. So not James Cameron wasn't just praising this film. Like, he really, he was apparently, you know, he was around for its conception and, you know, it's either read the draft or saw the original cut and went, you know, I think you should change that. I think you should consider moving that to the end. And that's exactly what Bill Paxton did. And it is, in my opinion, 100 times more effective that we don't see the visions. Which, again, if you're thinking about how pitch meetings work, or you're thinking about, you know, when you're trying to sell a movie to somebody, the idea that we're going to create tension because Bill Paxton touches somebody and then he sees something that we don't. Again, just like conceptually, that should not work. But, you know, the cinematography, the score, the direction here, the performances, everything creates atmosphere, and it creates a really dense atmosphere that things like that can happen. And because of kind of the accumulation of everything that's been going on, there is tension there. And I really love that about this movie. I also enjoy the fact, I didn't know this, and side note about me, for a while in my life was kind of a serial killer junkie. Like, I thought I got my degree in psychology, specifically forensic psychology, and thought that's what I was going to do. So, like, as we're sitting here recording this, there are two books on my top shelf that are like the encyclopedia of serial killers. But I had never heard of one particular killer who apparently this film is based on, Joseph Callinger, who in between 1974 and 1975, he murdered 3 people and tortured 4 families, and did so with his 13-year-old son, Michael. This was in New Jersey. And apparently at his trial, Callinger pleaded insanity, stating that God had told him to kill. So that's really the jumping off point for this script, is that it was kind of loosely based on this story of a guy who was religiously motivated in these murders that he committed along with his 13-year-old son, Michael. So that was kind of
interesting. And then asking the question, what if he was right?
Yeah.
What if he wasn't lying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's cool.
So absolutely, if you haven't seen this, if you were like me and you were in the dark, let this movie bring you to the light. Enjoy this film, like I said, as a non-traditional thriller, as possibly, as we've mentioned, the most faith-based Christian horror film of all time. You know,
the best. I would argue the best.
The best.
No. So, you know what? Strike that. We got to walk that back. The Exorcist exists.
What's the oh, the Exorcist exists. Oh, of course.
And The Omen is pretty fucking great too. But I would call it among, and you know, the thing is, I guess those are both very Catholic films, where this is very Protestant,
okay,
and very fundamentalist.
But here's the other thing. Both The Exorcist and The Omen have no room for doubt whatsoever that the devil exists. Those movies, like, you can't watch those movies with any other conclusion than what's happening is supernatural and that the devil exists. Whereas Frailty keeps that doubt in your mind, and it really is. You get to the end of that movie, and that turn makes you realize that it gave you all the information you needed, and it was up to whether you believed him or not. And that, in my opinion, makes this a better Christian film, because it is, everything does hinge on the idea of faith. Whereas, I'll start believing in God tomorrow if somebody spider walks down my stairs. That's all I'm saying.
That's true.
Only demons should fear me. You're not a demon, are you?
And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing of the day. And, of course, we're continuing, since this is all about Matthew McConaughey, we're continuing with the beer theme. And, of course, in this film, it's got to be hams.
Of
course. Hams beer. And before you jump up and head out to your local package store, you should know that Hams ceased to be its own brewery several years ago and is only still distributed in select markets. But that isn't the point.
If you haven't, go have a Hams.
Go have a Hams. And the reason I went with this particular brew is that if you notice in the film, that's what he's drinking. But in reality, Bill Paxton. But in reality, he was only drinking one can of Hams because they could only find one can in the 1970, like one Hams in the 1979 can. So what they would do is he would drink it. And then in other scenes, they would use sound effects and like have him open it off screen because it was already open. They literally had one can of Hams for the entire production. And even more appropriate for this film. Okay, so this film is the long revelation of a long buried dark past. Hams Brewery apparently has its own dark past. I had no idea about this. In 1933, company president William Ham Jr. was kidnapped from the brewery, and it was revealed decades later that certain corrupt St. Paul police officers were in on the kidnapping and pocketed portions of the $100,000 ransom that was paid to get him back. So this brewery has its own dark past, has its own demons to deal with.
So does St. Louis.
So does, well, St. Paul, Minnesota.
St. Paul. I thought you said St. Louis. Yeah, St. Paul. St. Paul is one of the nicest towns in the world. Fuck that.
So enjoy
that
this
story
beer.
Is terrible.
It's terrible. Enjoy this beer, maybe with a plate of actual ham. I don't know. Go nuts. And think about the demons in your own history. Spooky, scary. Well, that's going to do it for this episode, Chapter 2 of McGenre-hay.
McGenre-hay, baby.
McGenre-hay. We'll be back next week with a third film that I know is going to make Cargill very happy.
Oh, yes.
Until then, I want to remind you once again, you can find us on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And Cargill, where can people find you online?
On Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm. Or you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/Massaworm.
Outstanding. And you can find me on Twitter at BriarGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. Or if you have a few spare moments, why don't you pop over to my home away from home, which is oneofus.net. No matter what your fandom is, no matter what you're into, we have some kind of outlet for it via our various podcasts and blogs. Please check that out. I would greatly appreciate it. But until next week, for Cargo, this is Brian signing off. It was once said that sometimes truth defies reason. And given the fact that we're devoting a whole month to the star of Larger Than Life, I tend to agree.
Hey, hey.
That's McConaughey. Hey, hey.
McConaughey. Oh.